Welcome to Off Message. I'm Isaac Dover.
Donald Trump, he's not really a business leader. He's a business promoter. Those are very different things. I mean, business leaders, they pay their bills. They hire the best and the brightest. They think about their communities. They think about multiple stakeholders. They believe life is long and that you build relationships. And most importantly, they're focused on the future. They're always thinking about where the world is going and how to position their business. It's an amazing skill. Trump is kind of an anomaly because he doesn't really do any of those things. He never pays his bills. He doesn't hire the best people. He hires people who like tell him what he wants to hear. He defaults on everyone he does business with. And he's just maniacally focused on turning the clock back on everything.
Today's guest, John Delaney. He's a congressman from Maryland, right outside of Washington, D.C., but he's also the only announced Democratic candidate for president in 2020 so far. There will obviously be more, but they'll all be behind Delaney, who made a fortune for himself in what were essentially a couple of stopgap finance companies, helping provide the cash to medical institutions while they were waiting for the insurance reimbursements to come in. He announced his candidacy last summer after 3 terms in Congress. He's been to Iowa already 11 times. He's been to New Hampshire 8 times. He has commercials on the air. He just released his campaign book. And yet, I bet most of you have never heard of him. Didn't even know there was anyone officially running for president yet. For all the talk there is about it, and for all the expected presidential candidates you've heard on this podcast, and there will be more of them in the coming weeks. But he is running, and he has a relatively specific plan for what he'd do if he makes it to the White House. He also has a poll that he shared with me that shows his name ID at number 5 in Iowa, 52% after, in order, Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Cory Booker. So it's Biden, Sanders, Warren, Booker, Delaney. He's 11 points over Kamala Harris. A lot of others, like Eric Garcetti, aren't even on the list. So will John Delaney be president? Will he be the nominee? He knows it's a long shot. But he's putting a lot of his time and his money into it already. And it was definitely worth my time to read his book and make my way to the townhouse he owns a few blocks from the Capitol to get into it with him. As for this question of how people see the race against Trump shaping up and what they think it'll look like, it's one I get into in the article about this interview up on the Politico website, so please check that out. And before you've read it, or after, make sure you're subscribing and rating Off Message and leaving a review. Tell a friend, tell a coworker, tell your favorite family member, maybe even one you don't like so much, tell everybody. Catch up on old episodes online and get ready for so much more. Kirsten Gillibrand, Senator from New York, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, and that's just the start. You're not going to want to miss an episode. And of course, remember to follow me on Twitter, at Isaac Dover. I try to be entertaining and informative there, bringing you all sorts of other stories that I'm writing, and that others are too, in addition to tweeting interesting things going on in politics across the board. And send me your thoughts and comments by email at isaac@politico.com. Guest you'd like to hear? Suggestion you have for the show? Let me know. And now, my conversation with John Delaney.
So the story that opens the book is about my grandfather, Al Rowe,
right,
who was the one-armed immigrant, right?
And from Ireland?
From England, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm 3/4 Irish, 1/4 English. He was from England, and he came with his 7 brothers and sisters into Ellis Island, and he was detained because he had one arm, and he was a little boy. And the only reason he was ultimately let in the country is because a judge, during his appeal process, he was supposed to be deported. The judge that heard the appeal also had one arm. So that's the story that opens the book, which is kind of a classic American dream, turn of the 20th century immigrant kind of narrative.
And the big reveal at the end is that, it's the spoiler, is that he had his arm blown off by picking up a mine from World War I.
That's right. And you definitely read the book. And it was funny, when I first told that story, the first time I told that story was to our publisher.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, people must love that story. I'm like, well, I've never told it before. They're like, how could you run for office and never tell that story? That's such a great story.
Why haven't you told it before?
You know, I don't know. That's one of the things that has been the hard transition for me. I think coming from the private sector as an entrepreneur, I tend to be somewhat, okay, these are the facts.
Yeah.
This is what we should do. And the emotion around it is sometimes less important to me in my decision-making process.
So when you're around these politicians who are telling their stories all the time, did it just seem to you to be ridiculous?
I think they do overdo it, quite frankly. Look, I think personal stories are important, but I think at the end of the day, you also have to say something like what you're going to do for people. And so I think I was one of those people who would listen to them wax on and on and on about these personal stories and say to myself, well, that's great, but can I also hear what you're planning on doing about this, about this, about this, about this? We're electing people also to do a job, right? We're electing them for their character, for the judgment that they'll exhibit, which often is revealed by their personal stories and how they've lived their lives. But we're also electing them to do a job.
Yeah.
And we should care about how people think about things. Like, we should care about whether they think climate change is a problem or not. Because to me, someone who has a really good story but doesn't think climate change is a problem or doesn't believe we need criminal justice reform or thinks the public education system is doing just fine, I don't really care how good their personal stories are. You know, those things really matter to me in terms of the future of our country.
So you're running for president.
I am.
You say it out loud. You've been to Iowa 11 times.
Yes.
New Hampshire 8 times.
Yes.
How many other Democrats do you think, in your estimation, are running but just haven't said it the way that you've said it?
Well, I put them into two categories. There are people who may be running but don't really have to do anything to run. Joe Biden.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he doesn't have to make early trips to Iowa or New Hampshire.
Do you assume he's running?
No, but people assume he's running, and I'm sure he's thinking about it. So I don't put he and Senator Sanders in that category. They may be running. They may not be. Who knows? People consider them running, and I don't actually notice them in Iowa, New Hampshire. They don't really have to go to Iowa, New Hampshire.
I've been in New Hampshire with Joe Biden in April of last year. I think the only time that he—
But again, that's not an anomaly necessarily, right? So taking them out of the equation, I'd say there's about six or seven people who seem to be making the rounds in the two early states on a regular basis who, in my judgment, are only doing it because they're planning on running for president.
That's people like Eric Garcetti or Jeff Merkley.
Yes.
Right? And then there's like another group of people who most people assume are going to run.
Like Jason Kander, all these people.
Well, or like Elizabeth Warren or Cory Booker, Kamala Harris.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of speculation around
that. The senators haven't been there.
Yeah, they don't go to the states.
Well,
it's very funny
you said that. My assumption has been, and I have no independent confirmation of this, but just looking at their behavior, they must have cut a deal amongst themselves. Like a Senate kind of deal, which is, I don't want any of you all going to the early states, right? Because we've got to focus on the Senate. I don't know if that's true or not, but none of them have gone.
What do you say to the people who are playing this weird game of footsie?
Well, I don't say anything to them, but it's interesting. When I first went to Iowa, the first time last August, so many people came up to me and said, thank you for being honest about what you're doing and your ambitions. It was kind of the thank you for owning your ambitions moment. One person said, as part of thanking me for being honest, they said, you know, one of the issues we have with politicians these days is we don't think they're honest with us. And all these people come to Iowa, New Hampshire, and we know they're thinking about running for president or they're planning on running for president. And we ask them that question directly, and they lie to us.
Mm-hmm.
And so our first introduction to them is based on a dishonest moment. And so thank you for being honest about why you're here and what you're doing. And I never, that was a very much a surprise reaction. I never really thought, I mean, the reason I announced that I'm doing it was, A, I do better when I'm upfront with people about what I'm doing. So I would have a very hard time going to Iowa and New Hampshire and going around to these small towns and talking to people and then them asking me the question, are you thinking about running for president, and not saying, yes, that's why I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was hard for me to do it any other way.
That's what they think of the people who are probably running, but not saying it. What do you think of it? Isn't it frustrating to know that this is like your competition and that they're making moves, but like you're being clear where you are?
No, it's not frustrating to me because I think what I'm doing is a big advantage for that reason. I think I think one of the big issues with politics is what those people said, which is, you know, there's this cat and mouse game and the elected officials always make it about themselves.
Do you worry about like...
I mean, they should go there and say, yeah, I'm thinking about running for president. I'm not sure I am, but I'm thinking about it. And that's why I'm here.
Talking about your grandfather, you grew up in such different circumstances than your mother grew up in. And your children, your daughters, because of the money that you've made, grew up in different circumstances.
Yes.
When your mother and your daughters are talking to each other, can they process how different the lives are that are being led?
Well, I think my mother can. Mm-hmm. I grew up in circumstances probably very similar to my mother. Mm-hmm. I mean, my grandfather, who I write about in the book, worked in a pencil factory, and my dad was a union electrician. And our home growing up was three blocks from theirs. Mm-hmm. And our houses were...
This is in North Jersey.
Yeah, in Woodridge, New Jersey. Our houses were pretty much the same. Small kind of Sears Roebuck style houses, mm-hmm. as I write in the book. So I think my childhood was actually in some ways very similar to my mother's. Mm-hmm. We grew up in the same town and literally on the same street, just three blocks away from each other. Now, my children have had lived a different life because I've been blessed to be fortunate in business.
How fortunate have you been in business?
I think I've been very blessed.
But when we think about it, how much are you worth?
Well, I mean, I don't disclose that number specifically, but there's lots of stories written about it because I have to disclose my financial statements to the Congressional Records, and I can assure you that they're accurate.
Okay. That's a weird way to dodge that question.
No, I'm not trying to dodge the question because I don't want to be dishonest with you, right? I know what I'm worth, and I don't want to initially say that per se, but the Congressional Records are accurate. They're not precise, but they're directionally accurate.
Okay. So you were saying that you've been fortunate and your daughters have grown up in those circumstances.
Yeah. But again, I mean, I think the way I think about it, I don't think we've worked hard, my wife and I, not to spoil our daughters, but, you know, they've been blessed and we've been blessed at some of the basic things that I think a lot of families really do worry about. My children haven't had to worry about, like, how do you pay for college? Mm-hmm. And some of the basic things in life.
Right, because you went on a union scholarship
My children did not need a union scholarship to go to college because my wife and I can afford to send them to college, and we do. And so they don't have to take out student loans as a result. Things like that. So, mm-hmm. you know, there's those kind of things that are clearly different.
And a nicer house and all that stuff. I assume the family vacations are not bad.
Yeah. I mean, to me, the real blessing of having some financial success, which is what I've had, is it gives me the privilege of living a life that I think is meaningful. In other words, in doing what I really want to do with my life to make a difference. And it gives me the freedom and to do that, which I think a lot of people in life want to do more in terms of public service and even community service. And they probably can't because they're, don't have that kind of flexibility. So that to me is the biggest blessing. And I think it allows me to say to my children, you should do what you want in life. You should do what gives you, gives you the most meaning, that allows you to make the greatest contribution, that makes you excited to get up every day in the morning. And you have the blessing of a good education and you're not burdened with student debt. So that's actually... Freedom is the ultimate blessing in the world, both the freedoms we have in this country and to the extent people have individual freedoms to pursue what they want to do with their lives. I think it's a great thing. And so I think that's probably the greatest thing we've given our kids. You know, they don't have to worry about their education and they don't have to worry about their healthcare.
Yeah.
So that kind of allows them to do what they want with their lives.
You had thought about running for governor.
I did.
Of Maryland. You decided to run for president instead.
Yes, I did.
Why'd you make that decision?
It felt like the work.
As a Republican incumbent governor of Maryland?
Yeah, Governor Hogan. And it really wasn't based on a political calculus in the state of Maryland. A lot of people have asked me, well, was it because the governor of Maryland is popular and you thought that was a tough race? That really wasn't it. What I think is really broken in this country is what I'm running for president on, which is how divided the country is and how we're not focused at the future. The most broken aspect of the government and the governments in this country is the federal government. State and local governments are actually, in my judgment, not that broken. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's certain states where they're broken, and you're seeing examples of that in Kansas. We're starting to see that in Iowa now, actually. Mm-hmm. But in general, the most broken aspect of our governments generally is the federal government. And I think there's tremendous dysfunction and gridlock and a lack of solutions, and the American people are paying a huge, huge price for this. A big theme of my book is how the world's changing so rapidly. And I've always been obsessed with change in my business career. And now since I've been in Congress, one of the reasons I founded something like the Artificial Intelligence Caucus, which people thought was a strange idea when I originally said, this is what we're going to do. Because I think the fundamental responsibility of government, of the leaders in government, is to think about what's happening in the world and where it's going, and to do things to prepare our citizens for that world so that their future is more secure, more prosperous, and more just. And we've largely stopped doing that in the last 20 or 30 years, in my opinion. We've been gridlocked. We don't even do the most basic things get done 15 minutes before the deadline, whether it's funding the government or, you know, extending the debt ceiling, let alone doing the kind of things we need to be doing to create the kind of new social compact that I think we need in society to prepare ourselves. And I think in many ways, if you want to summarize what's happened in this world is and why so many people have been left behind, it's because the world has changed and the institutions in society have not, which doesn't mean they need to be bigger or smaller. It just needs to, they need to change. You know, my dad had one job for 60 years. My grandfather had one job for 50 years. People in the future are likely to have 5, 6, 7 jobs. So does it make sense to have their health care and their retirement tied to their job? Of course not. That was a great model when you had one job. You know, you got out of school, you took a job, you retired from that job, and your health care and retirement was tied to that job. That all made terrific sense. Doesn't make sense in the world. Basic stuff like that. We talk about what's happened with social media. You know, if I put one of my television ads on, or one of my commercials on television, or if I put it on radio, I have to disclose who paid for it. Paid for by John Delaney for president. If I put that exact same ad on social media, I don't have to disclose anything. So the Russians decided to advertise on social media, not because they thought it was better than television, but it's because they knew they didn't have to disclose they were doing it.
It's and because it maybe hits more people who are voters that way.
I think it's more they just didn't have to tell them they were doing it. I mean, if you're running any kind of a campaign, everyone says, well, you should do some radio, television, social media, right? They just did social media, not because they said, oh, it's so much better than everything else. It's just like, hey, we can do this. No one knows. Because those folks in the United States, for reasons they probably couldn't understand, never updated the campaign disclosure rules to say that ads on social media require the same disclosure. I mean, how obvious is that, that it's something we should do? But it's just an example of how the world changes and a gridlock government doesn't update anything. And so who pays the price? The American people. So that's why I'm running for president and not governor, because this is where the issues are.
Seems like you've hated your time in Congress.
No, I've loved my time in Congress.
Really?
Absolutely.
Doesn't it drive you just crazy? You came in wanting to get one bill passed about tax money from overseas and infrastructure.
Yeah.
You've been in working on it.
Yep.
Pretty much nonstop for 6 years.
Yep. And then they did the tax bill and that did half the bill, not the other half.
Right. And they're not picking up the other half.
No. That's very frustrating. No question. But that's also why I'm running for president. But I haven't at all hated my time in Congress. I think it's been it's a real privilege to serve the country. Mm-hmm. I think the people that I've met doing this public service that I've done have been terrific. I've made some terrific friends. And, you know, I enjoy the debate. I enjoy the fight. You know, would I like it to be more productive? Would I have liked to have been in the majority? Absolutely. It would have been a much better experience. But
you've served entirely in the minority, right?
Entirely. But I don't regret my decision to run for the House of Representatives at all. And I really love the House of Representatives. I think it's just the raw edge of American democracy, and you just learn so much.
A lot of what you write about and what you talk about is bipartisanship.
Yes.
Give me an issue where the Democrats are wrong and Donald Trump is right.
So I think, well, people have often asked me, what did I approve of that Donald Trump has done? And what I said was the strike on Syria. So I think that was the
Which
right
one?
Thing to do.
The one this year?
Both
the
of
one.
Them.
Okay.
So I was supportive of both.
Even
of
though
them.
There's not any larger strategy that most people
no.
can see around them.
And I would like to
and
see
that there was no congressional authorization. You're okay with that?
Yeah. I would like to have seen a larger strategy. Obviously, I think one of the failures of the Trump administration and to some extent the Obama administration is Syria. And we've allowed
but
the,
so
the administration.
In a year and a half of the Trump presidency, talking about bipartisanship, you can point to essentially two evenings, 59 Tomahawk missiles last year. And I don't remember exactly what the number was a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Well, let's talk about what they've done, right? They tried to, the first 6 months of the administration was spent them trying to take healthcare away from 20 million people, which I thought was a terrible thing. And they refused to act upon bipartisan bills. Look, think of that Murray-Alexander bill that we were all obsessed with at the time. and that they, those two senators were promised, my recollection is they were promised there'd be action on it. Those are bipartisan bills. Those are great senators. They worked hard on something. I believe those bills would pass with huge majorities in both the House and the Senate. No action on it. So the early term of the president was dealing with, you know, dismantling the Affordable Care Act. And then they moved to tax reform, which I didn't support. That doesn't mean I didn't support things in the tax bill. Two things that I worked very hard on, including my social impact bond legislation, were in fact in the tax bill. And the other bill I worked really hard on was the Distressed Opportunity Act. Those are two really good pieces of law that were passed as part of the tax bill. And I do think the fix on international tax was the right thing to do in that tax bill.
But it's taking money basically that companies have parked overseas.
Well, changing the international tax system so they don't have an incentive to keep it over there and doing it in a way that generates money for the federal government. They actually did that in the bill. I would have paired it with infrastructure. I mean, the mistake I think they made was they cut the corporate tax rate way too low. They cut the corporate tax rate to 21%. For 10 years, the business community lobbied Washington to cut the rate to 25%. I mean, they would come and they would, the business roundtable and the Chamber of Commerce, all these people would say 25%. If we could just have a 25% corporate tax rate, we could be more competitive with the world. And I understood their argument. I mean, we did have the highest corporate tax rate in the world. When President Bill Clinton raised our corporate tax rate to 35%, all the other countries had high rates. He was basically moving the rate up to equal our international competitors. Since then, all the international competitors have lowered their rate. I think most people like myself, even President Obama, thought that we could get the rate to 27 or 28%. So the bid ask used to be 27, 28% is where Democrats wanted to get corporate tax. 25% is where Republicans. And then we wake up and it's a 21. Like no one even asked for that. Every 1% of corporate tax reduction is $100 billion. Can you imagine how much better this tax bill would have been if instead of cutting the rate to 21%, they cut it to 25%? Which is where the business community wanted it, and we had $400 billion going into infrastructure, and that $400 billion was used to create a $1 trillion infrastructure program. That would have been a bill, for example, that the Republicans could have started a conversation with Democrats about. Whether we would have gotten there or not is a different question, but—
Seems hard to believe that the Democrats would have gotten there.
A $1 trillion infrastructure plan? I don't know. You know, it's getting close.
You write in the book, the American people have correctly diagnosed that we have a problem, but the remedy they've chosen, Donald Trump, is completely incapable of fixing it.
Yeah.
So this, I was thinking about you and your race and how you structure your entire approach to public life and how Donald Trump did, and also how Barack Obama did, where presidential campaigns especially, but throughout politics, it seems like it's movements. People want to believe in the story and you are about drilling down into sometimes not very interesting, sexy issues.
Right.
Do you really think that in this political environment that that will be able to catch in the way that you want it to?
So I think what my campaign is really about more than the policy details, because the longer I'm in this race, the more I become convinced that these elections are not about a bunch of policy choices. I think I'm right on the policy things I stand for. I've written a book about it. It's all in there. But I think
it basically boils down to the line that he used it twice in the book. The cost of doing nothing is not nothing, right?
And really the issue there is the fact that we're so divided. I think the central question facing the United States of America in 2020 is how do we take this terribly divided nation and bring it back together? And I'm running a campaign based on that. If the American people are fundamentally not looking for that in 2020, they will absolutely not elect me. But if they are, I think I'm the right answer to that question because I have an approach for governing and leadership that I think can bring people together.
That the running against division was in part what powered Obama in 2008, but it was people connecting with him and the idea of Barack Obama as this uniting figure.
Mm-hmm.
You want to do it as the guy who is not super emotional, isn't that? And part of the issue that Obama ran into is that then a lot of people assumed that they knew what he stood for, and he had never said, yes, he stood for these set of positions on a lot of things, or no, he didn't. And then that created a lot of issues. You're pretty clear on what you believe in.
Yeah.
But without the emotion in the same way.
I wouldn't say there's no emotion to it. I mean, I just think it's like appealing to the better angels of the American people. I think the American people are actually at our core, we don't want to be divided. I don't think.
Do you think that that's? I wonder about this now, because like that's what the conversation always becomes. This people don't want to be divided, but people are divided, and so at a certain point, doesn't it become? You have to look at what is actually happening. People do want to cheer for their team and against the other team, right?
But what I want them to do is to cheer for the American team, right? You know, I think tribalism is a very powerful force in this world, obviously. But I think the one thing that's been different about the United States of America is the pride that our citizens have shown in our country historically, how we are a very unique country, how this great experiment that people weren't sure if was going to work did in fact work beyond people's wildest imaginations, I expect. And there's a tremendous amount of pride in the country that we've done great and noble things across time. And the way we've done that is by coming together as a people. So I want to run a campaign based on restoring that sense of optimism about what our country can do. And I think it starts by making the American people feel more trusting of their government.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. You have in your book, I counted one point, 22 bullet points of areas that you want to fix. Mm-hmm. Getting into some level of specificity,
you
obviously.
You counted them.
I did.
That's impressive.
Okay. I can both read and count. you don't have like the bills laid out,
no.
But it's some specificity about what you would do. And it actually made me think of this moment, and this is the danger of watching too many episodes of The West Wing years ago. But there is a scene towards the end when the guy who ends up winning, the Jimmy Smits character, is meeting with Leo McGarry, who's his running mate. And he has this ambitious plan of all that he wants to do. And he says, okay, no, you don't have 4 years. You have maybe until the midterms, your first midterms. And really, you only have like 6-7 months.
Yeah.
So like take that whole list. We're going to get maybe through the first page of it.
Right.
That may not be an exact verbatim representation of the scene, but that's the gist of it. So what's the thing that you think you could actually get done off your list for real, would pass through Congress with President John Delaney, that would have the kind of impact that you want to have?
So I'll answer the question in the context of the rules I've laid out in the book, right? So the first thing I said is, in my first 100 days, I'll only do bipartisan legislation. And so what I want to be able to do is when I'm...
What does bipartisan mean? Does it mean getting one Republican senator to work with you?
No, it means deep, kind of meaningful bipartisan.
Like when Barack Obama said Obamacare was going to be bipartisan.
You know, it's like what I did on infrastructure and repatriation, 40 Democrats, 40 Republicans.
Yeah.
That, you know, if it went to the floor, would pass.
Right.
With deep support in each party. Comprehensive immigration reform that was passed in the Senate, that I viewed as truly bipartisan. It was either 17 or 19 Republicans at the time. I mean, you know, 35-40% of the party that is historically been harder on the issue, to me, strikes me as meaningful bipartisan support. Mm-hmm. So my first 100 days, I want to look at the American people when I'm inaugurated and say, I believe I represent every American, whether you voted for me or not. And to prove it, in our first 100 days, we're going to work on these things that your elected representatives in the Congress, as Democrats and Republicans, have come together and have a consensus on. And to me, there's three areas right now in this country where there's pretty broad consensus. The first is infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
Both Democrats and Republicans believe we should be investing more in our infrastructure. We debate about how to pay for it. There's different ideas how to do it.
Right. So this is the question, because President Trump, the first thing he said basically is president-elect, about, okay, we're going to do infrastructure.
But he didn't put forth a bipartisan
plan. That's right. So tell me, I get that you also want infrastructure. What do you think you could actually get done for real with that bipartisan support?
I think you could basically generate a couple hundred billion dollars of new infrastructure spending, probably by tying it to a gas tax increase. And you could allocate that money in a way where some of it went to an infrastructure bank and the rest went directly to the states for their governors to allocate the money. And I think you could get pretty big bipartisan support for that bill.
For a gas tax?
I do. The president didn't propose it.
Do you think if he proposed something like that now, there would be an appetite for it?
Well, going back to your West Wing analogy, the window has closed, so to speak. Do you see what I mean? But imagine if he would have proposed that in his first 100 days.
Another idea that you have that you want to open up as president, you would do like your version of prime minister's questions that they do in Britain.
Once a quarter. What I'm proposing is something that's 3 hours and it's once a quarter and it's nationally televised. And there'll be rules. The first hour and a half would be one particular topic, immigration, whatever, education, whatever it wants to be. And the reason I think this is important has nothing to do with the members of Congress or the president. It has to do entirely with the American people and the fact that one of the things that is really hurting us right now is the sense of who's telling the truth.
Mm-hmm. Do you think Donald Trump tells the truth about things?
No.
Do you think he did during the debates? He did a lot of debates.
You know, he generally was not fact-based in anything he said in the debates, my recollection, right? So I think the amount – no, but seriously, I'm trying to remember. I mean, I don't remember the debates kind of verbatim, but I think his level of dishonesty around the facts has grown since he's been the president relative to the debates. I'm not talking about his campaign generally.
What do you think would happen if President Trump did one of these?
I don't think he could do it.
Why not?
Because he just doesn't have any master – he doesn't seem to know what he's doing from a policy perspective. I mean, quite frankly, he doesn't seem to know any of the details or any of the facts or care about them. Right? He makes decisions based on what he perceives to be in his best interest at that moment of time. I mean, think about what he did when he brought all those – I mean, he had his own version of this, I suppose, when he had those press conferences in the White House. Remember after DACA?
Mm-hmm.
Or around DACA, he had the senators, I think it was,
mm-hmm.
and he told them to go negotiate a deal, that they're good people, and if you negotiate a deal, I'll sign it.
Yeah.
Well, they actually did.
Right. And then he didn't sign it.
He didn't sign it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he's a, you know, I'm talking about the presidency I plan on having. I mean, so
well,
I
but
think
you would theoretically be running against him.
Yes.
You would be in a debate with him.
Yes, I would be in a debate with him.
So how'd that go?
I think it'll go great. I really do.
If he's going to be going at it the way that he goes at things and you going at it the way it seems like it would be very different debating styles.
You know, someone once told me this and I thought it was a good analogy. It's kind of like playing poker. There are two types of poker players, the ones that play the players and ones that play the hand. Donald Trump plays the player. He doesn't play the hand. The hand's irrelevant to him. So you just have to understand what you're dealing with.
I feel like he plays craps, not poker.
Probably true. But you have to understand what you're dealing with. I think it wouldn't be hard to debate him at all, actually.
You play the hand?
I play the hand, but I also know if I'm playing someone who plays the player. That's the key.
When I told people I was coming to do this podcast with you, this was the reaction that I got. I got two sets of reactions. First one was, like, who? Or like, he's not going to win, right? What do you say to those people?
Well, the who,
let's do the second one.
Yeah. I feel very confident I'm going to win. I think the message, I mean, I've done 185 stops, campaign stops in Iowa, New Hampshire. And the message that I'm talking to people about, which is what I believe, is that we have to come together as a country and focus on the future. I think every head in the room nods. And I've been in meetings with thousands of Democrats in Iowa, New Hampshire. And so my strategy is clearly an early state strategy. And that's why I've done all these trips to these states. That's why I've done all these events in these states. And I feel like it really doesn't matter at this point how many people know me in Washington or New York or California. What really matters is how many people know me in Iowa. And we did a poll not long ago. I think I have the fifth highest name ID of any of the 15 or 20 people you would name as possible Democrats running for president in the state of Iowa. We've been on television since February. And so I think our strategy in Iowa, New Hampshire is sound. It's a good one. In some ways, it's an old-fashioned strategy. It's very similar to Jimmy Carter's strategy.
He was just on the podcast.
Yeah. Get in early. He did 32 visits to Iowa. No one had heard of him. And I think that the good Democrats who are very sophisticated and very smart in Iowa, New Hampshire, understand that their role in the presidential election is to find people that no one else has heard of. In fact, they take a lot of pride in that. And so it doesn't really – I mean, obviously, I would like to be more well-known across the country. I understand that. But I think I will become very well-known in Iowa, New Hampshire when someone does a poll next year and I do well in that poll. Then I'll be well-known overnight.
And to the people in Washington who write you off at the moment?
Yeah, it's not – again, I believe the campaign I'm running is not only the right campaign for the country, but it's the right campaign to win. And so – I've been underestimated before. I mean, I was the youngest CEO in the history of the New York Stock Exchange. I'm sure when I was starting that company, when I was 30 years old and I took it public 3 years later, most people didn't think it would be successful. I remember talking to people about the business and no one wanted to get involved in it. So, you know, when I ran for this seat, some of my closest friends who were really pretty sophisticated political types said, oh, you'll never win. I was running against the majority leader of the Maryland State Senate, who had the endorsement of literally every single elected official in the state of Maryland, the governor on down. And the whole Maryland political establishment was behind him. But, you know, we kept our head down and we ran our campaign. And we executed and we won. Because I think at the end of the day, the voters are always a lot smarter than people think they are. So I just think that the fact that I'm not particularly well-known nationally is not really all that relevant, because when I do well in some, not only in the early caucuses and primary, but when I do well in a poll next year in Iowa, New Hampshire, that'll all change overnight.
Let's leave it at this. someone told me that your wife said to you that you could spend a certain amount of money on this race and gave you a number. Is that right?
If anything, it would be the opposite. You know, I'm really blessed to be married to April, who we met in law school, as you know in the book. And she's a big believer in public service and public policy. And she helped kind of start a nonprofit called Common Sense Media, which deals with media literacy and the children. And she has been an amazing supporter. And I would say on the issue that you're talking about, if each of us were to talk about how much we should invest in this, there's no question her number would be higher than mine.
But you don't have a number set?
No. No. I mean, this is what I believe. We're going to run a really good campaign through Iowa and New Hampshire. And I'm out talking to people. Fortunately, I have a lot of supporters. And fortunately, April and I are in a position to invest in our campaign. So that we, just like in every one of my campaigns, we have a budget and we always can fund our budget. Mm-hmm. And it's always a mix of people who want to support me versus what I invest in the campaign. So that's the least of my worries. We're going to run. Now, I'm not going to be able to self-fund a campaign all the way through being president. But listen, I feel so strongly that, and I say this to people, if in 2020 people are not looking for someone to try to bring us together and focus on the future, then they are absolutely not going to elect me. Because it's one of the great advantages of going early, which is not only do you get to listen to people, not only do you get to spend more time introducing yourselves, but you basically get out there and you say exactly what you believe and there's no one else running.
Yeah.
So you're not affected by what anyone else says. It doesn't even enter your radar screen. So by the time everyone gets into this race, I will have pretty much told everyone what I believe about pretty much every issue, and I'm not wavering from it a minute. So if they want someone to be the Democratic version of Donald Trump, they're not going to pick me. If they want someone to try to bring the country together and focus on the future, and I do believe campaigns are about the future.
Yeah, because Donald Trump doesn't run the country like a businessman like you would.
Well, it's not like he doesn't run the country like a businessman. You know, Donald Trump, he's not really a business leader. He's a business promoter. Those are very different things. I mean, business leaders, they pay their bills. They hire the best and the brightest. They think about their communities. They think about multiple stakeholders. They believe life is long and that you build relationships. And most importantly, they're focused on the future. I mean, in business, I will say the one thing about business that is different than politics, people in business are obsessed with the future. They're always thinking about where the world is going and how to position their business. It's an amazing skill. I think it's probably the best skill that I take with me from the business world. Trump is kind of an anomaly because he doesn't really do any of those things. He never pays his bills. He doesn't hire the best people. He hires people who like tell him what he wants to hear. He defaults on everyone he does business with. And he's just maniacally focused on turning the clock back on everything. So you asked about debates. I think the debates are easy. And you say to the American people, do you want to keep turning the clock back or do you want to focus on the future? It's always better to focus on the future.
All right. Congressman John Delaney,
thank you
for taking the time.
So what do you think? Can you squint and see John Delaney on stage debating Donald Trump? And what do you make of what he said about the authenticity of actually saying what he's doing, admitting that he's running, and just going for it? Is that appealing? Or do you not care? Email me at isaac@politico.com and let me know. And of course, follow me on Twitter @IsaacDovere. Thanks as always to Zach Stanton for producing. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any of the episodes coming, including that one with Kirsten Gillibrand talking about the sexual harassment legislation in Congress and many more things that she's up to. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, which we'll be doing from Boston. And there are a bunch more great ones that we're in the final stages of nailing down, and I'm really looking forward to telling you about soon. Catch you next time on Off Message.